Welcome to another in our series of Kehillat Israel podcasts. This is a recording of Rabbi Amy Bernstein's weekly Friday morning Torah study.
We are going to begin Parshat Shemini. We're going to begin at chapter 10, verse 4. We're going to do something weird today with this Parsha because I went down a few rabbit holes. So we're not going to do what you think. So we are not going to do the death of Nadav and Avihu. We're not going to do it. And we're not going to do a big discussion of the laws of Kashrut. Those are the big topics in Parshat Shemini. We have the whole story of Nadav and Avihu, which we've done many times together. And we have the laws of Kashrut enumerated in great detail. And so we are not going to spend a lot of time in either one of those. Rather, what I'd like to do is take a 30,000-foot view of this sequence and try to understand a little bit about why is Kashrut put where it's put? What is the context, you know, that Kashrut is really coming to talk about? And then what we're going to spend the last part of our time in the sources, we're going to really look at the idea of purification, and how that gets brought forward in both our texts and in practice. So we are going to begin right after the deaths of Nadav and Avihu. For our purposes, I want to stay with the interpretation that we got to last year through, I believe it was Zornberg, Aviva Zornberg. I don't want to lie, but I think it was. We had this whole conversation about what went wrong, what did they do? And we had a conversation in which the conclusion was, and I want to just stay with this one. I'm not saying it's the right one, but I think it makes the most sense to me when we look at what follows. I mean, you can make an argument, other conclusions support what follows, is that Nadav and Avihu were anxious that the divine presence was not coming down to fill the sanctuary and to consume the sacrifices. And they got very nervous and they did what folks do who are used to doing certain things a certain way. And they brought fire from a regular source, which is what the priests were supposed to do to keep the fire burning, but not this day. This day it was supposed to be like the fire from the divine presence that was supposed to come down and consume the sacrifices. They got nervous and they brought regular fire so that the sacrifices should be consumed. And the interpretation that we learned last year is as the fire went forth from the Holy of Holies, it consumes the incense and then it goes straight from the incense altar out to the big altar. They were bringing in the interior, they were bringing their fire pans, right? And so the fire consumes them as it blazes forth. They're in the wrong place at the wrong time doing the wrong thing. They're trying to do the right thing, but they did it out of being anxious, not out of following instructions. So they are like obliterated as the fire goes out, consumes the incense, and then consumes the animals on the altar. They didn't get out. They didn't trust it was going to happen. And so they are burned in the process of what was supposed to unfolding. There was a wonderful term that brought about this when people are kind of addicted to the norm. Ooh. Like it was such a great term. Maybe it'll come to me, but before the end of this,
because I have no idea what you're.
It's great. It's great. It's a great word. Like that. It's a mania about doing what's normal, not being able to subjectively read a situation and know what to do in that situation. And the other word that gets thrown around in by Zornberg in this Parsha is Egyptomania, which is a great word. Egyptomania. So like the ways that Egypt rendered folks a little nutty. You know, some of our responses coming out of Egypt are Egyptomania. That it's not about responding to what is right now. It's from what happened in Egypt. So let's begin looking at, this is immediately following the death of Nadav and Avihu. We are at chapter 10, verse 4. So what is Aaron's response to the death of his two sons? Vayidom Aharon.
Not up on your
screen. Aharon was silent.
Okay. Adam's right.
I am screen sharing, so I'm not sure
why it didn't. Adam's here.
Not sure.
just looking for a tab that's not in this bank?
Huh?
Are you looking for a tab?
No, I'm in this tab, Leviticus 10:4. So it shows here, but it doesn't show there. Pardon me, it's only been 4 years since I've been using that technology.
I can relate.
Some people are slow learners. That's exactly right.
So share that.
Yeah. Thank you.
There you go.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Adam.
I'm always like, no, I don't need it. It's fine. And then he's in here three times before we've even started. All right. So we have this fire consuming two sons. We have Vayidom Aharon. Aharon was silent. Vayikra Moshe Mishael ve'el El Tzafon. Now Moshe goes to Mishael and El Tzafon, B'nei Uziel. So he goes to the first cousins of those who have died, and says, come forward and carry away your kinsmen away from the front of the sanctuary to a place outside the camp, right? So now you can't have corpses in the sacred space, obviously. So they come forward, they carry them out by their tunics as Moshe ordered. And Moshe says to Aaron and his remaining sons, do not bare your heads, do not rend your clothes, lest you die and anger strike the whole community. But your kin, all the house of Israel, shall bewail the burning. That, I don't like this translation at all, because it makes it sound like it is a purposeful action. It just says, all of Israel will bewail the burning with which God burned. Because it could just be, right, this is what happens when God's fire comes forth to consume the sacrifices. It doesn't mean God has wrought this. It means the fire came forth to consume the sacrifices, and it did burning. And two of the things that got burned were in the way. Do not go outside the tent of meeting, lest you die, for God's anointing oil is upon you. And they did as Moshe had bidden. So they've just been anointed. Like this was the whole fireworks that ends the ordination, right? This is the sanctification of the Mishkan. This is the 8-day whole thing. So this was supposed to be the big firework ending. And instead, it turns out to be an accident with fireworks that kills two people. But they have the anointing oil on them, so they can't go out into a place that is profane. And God speaks to Aaron saying, drink no wine or other intoxicant, you or your sons, when you enter the tent of meeting, that you may not die. This is a law for all time throughout the ages. So we talked before about why is this verse here? And the rabbis, some of them want to suggest it's not an accident ever that Torah talks about things the way it talks about it, and that this is here because part of what went wrong, part of what made their Esh Zarah, their offering that was called strange fire, what made it illegal was that they offered it while they were intoxicated. And that is why Torah says, be sure you don't go into holy service with your mind being muddled in any way. So again, if we stay with our interpretation of what happened, what it might mean is make sure your head is clear and you're making good decisions, because this is what happens when you don't, when you just act out of your own like anxiety or whatever, and you go rushing in, you know, your brain is kind of muddled by that and you make a decision that winds up being fatal.
And we have to remember that in a lot of societies, being intoxicated was considered to bring you closer to God.
Correct.
And this was another thing of saying the Israelite God is different. You don't
Correct.
Come intoxicated, because you need to have, it had to do with the dignity of the human who was there. You had to bring your humanness and your clarity of individuality into the sacred space.
Okay. Commentary by Bert Kleinman. Tune in every week. For you must distinguish between the sacred and the profane, and between the impure and the pure. Okay, so here's our red flag. All of a sudden, we're getting instruction. They can't go out with the anointing oil on, and don't come in here for sacred service drunk, because you must distinguish between Kodesh, that which is holy, and that which is regular, and between what? Tameh and Tahor. This is the reason we're about to get a whole bunch of discussion about a whole bunch of different things that are about this distinction between Tameh and Tahor. And the scholarship that I was in a rabbit hole with this week was about, because it is vitally important to the presence of the protective force of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh that is only what? Tahor, and only Kadosh, that the camp stay Tahor and Kadosh. God's presence cannot be somewhere where Kedusha or Tahara is compromised. So it's really about safety, right? This is a safety manual. If we want the divine presence to rest here, and that means we're going to be safe and protected, then there are certain things that need to be mitigated. Everyone is going to be Tameh at some point. Everybody is in chol most of the time, right? The question is being vigilant about where Kedusha has to be preserved and where Tumah has to be dealt with, okay? So if we stay there, then what follows starts to not feel so random and weird that we get kashrut right after the deaths of Nadav and Abihu. Right? If it's about this business of Tumah and Tahara, and if it's about Kedusha and Chol, Kadosh and Chol, then it starts to make some sense that now we're going to have a discussion about all of the things that implicate one's state of being in Kadosh or Chol and in Tameh or Tahor. Okay? You must teach the Israelites all the laws which Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is imparted to them through Moshe. So now Moshe talks to Eleazar and Itamar and is upset with them for not offering what was their portion of a chatat offering. And this was another rabbit hole I went down, but we're not going to do it. Maybe next year. They were supposed to eat it because it was their due. It's the part of the chatat that was their due. But it had been burned up. And so Moshe gets angry with Eleazar and Itamar, Aaron's sons, saying, why didn't you eat it in the sacred area? We're just talking now about where they can eat it. They can't eat it in a place that's chol. They can only eat it in a place that's kadosh because it's a sacred offering. So once that meat is sacral meat, it has to be eaten in the sacral space. It has to be eaten in a place that's kadosh. So Moshe's upset. That didn't happen. The whole thing got burnt. So he doesn't go to whom? Who doesn't he go to here? He doesn't go to Aaron, the high priest. They're going, what's up? Instead, some people want to say it's about protecting Aaron's dignity. He goes to Aaron's sons and yells at them. And they answer, well, the blood was not brought inside the sanctuary. He's still talking. Sorry, it's still Moshe. Its blood had not been brought into the sanctuary, so you should have eaten it. Once the blood is brought into the sanctuary, it's burned. You don't eat it. So Aaron answers for his sons. Aaron understands this is code for, it's really, the buck stops with me. You're yelling at my kids, but really, I'm the CEO of the Mishkan. The buck's, it's ultimately my responsibility, right? And so, and maybe a little defensive of his sons. But notice he doesn't answer for them. He answers in the first person. So he really is answering the charge that he didn't eat it. So Aaron says, see, this day they brought their sin offering and their burnt offering before Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, and such things have befallen me. Had I eaten the sin offering today, would Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh have approved? And when Moshe heard this, it was good in his eyes. So Moshe is appeased. So there's lots of explanations offered about what is Aaron actually saying, but he seems to be saying something about, had I eaten the sin offering in the state of mourning I was in, that would not be, are you telling me God would have wanted that? And some sources say this is about Moshe's humility, that Moshe is like, oh, right, I forgot, you're not supposed to eat sacrifices, even in a place that's kadosh, when you're in mourning, and oops, okay, we're all good, right? So that he's so humble, he admits he forgot a law of halacha. I think it's a little cheeky, whatever. Like, you know, he could have said, I'm sorry, I forgot, right? But it was good in his eyes. It seems acceptable. And so now we move on to God speaking to Moshe and Aharon right after all of this, saying, these are the things that you can eat, chapter 11, from all the land animals, right? So we're not going to go into a lot of detail about which are kosher, which are not. Why do we think so? Why do we not? Suffice it to say that all over the ancient Near East, there were prohibitions against eating certain things. Everywhere in the ancient Near East, we have it, not just in, places that you would imagine, that are related to early Israelites or Mesopotamian culture, but also Arameans, Canaanites, Ethiopians, and ancient Greeks. All of them had food taboos. All of them. And terrestrial human culture is such that in many, many, many cultures, if you look at what someone, another culture eats, what do we do if we don't eat that? Ew. Right? When I watched my father eat brain.
Well, we don't eat dogs.
Disgusting.
We don't eat dogs.
Right? There's many things we don't eat, that, but we don't tend to go, oh, that's interesting. Y'all eat that. Let me try that because we don't eat that. That is not the typical human response. We are seriously ethnocentric about eating, and it tends to disgust us if we don't eat that and other people do, particularly when you're talking about animals, like creatures, right? Vegetables, whatever. Do I love parts of palm? No. Do I freak out when I see Harvey eat them? No, right? But if Harvey's sitting over there with a bowl of grasshoppers, right? It's just like, ew, David.
When does the drinking of wine become integrated? Is that a temple thing or is that a post-temple thing?
It's post-temple. It's when the ritual moves into the home. It's not a temple rite.
So nobody was...
There are libation offerings, but taking a cup of wine and doing something over it and then drinking it is not part of the temple rite. Yes.
I was just going to add to what you said. When you travel a lot, you go into societies where their diets are different. You're insulting them if you don't try some of the things they eat. And I think you have to kind of learn to try the things that they eat.
Or don't travel.
You have that choice.
There's that option.
Sometimes they just serve you something, you don't know what it is, it tastes good, and then they tell you later. Or don't travel.
Okay, no way. So, it is most people's customs to kind of be grossed out by things living that other people eat that we don't eat. This is common since ancient times. And we have codes in these other cultures that I mentioned, Ethiopia, Greece, certainly Mesopotamia, Canaan, of course. We have lots of Egypt. We have lots of codes about what people eat and what they don't eat. It is fairly common to find creepy, crawly things disgusting. Like you shouldn't be encouraged to eat those, right? Like it's a survival thing, like as last resort, right? You know, but it's so. Among things that people tend to say, we don't eat that, are creepy crawly things. Among some birds in the bird family, some birds in many cultures, birds of prey, right? So things that eat other dead things were understood to communicate disease. Bert's going to talk about how spiritually we shouldn't take in meat of something that kills other things, right? So there's a spiritual thing that we don't do. Okay. So whether you make it physical or spiritual, it is understood that we refrain from eating things that eat other dead things, both among sea creatures and flying creatures. And, for Israelites, also animals. The animals that we are allowed to eat are what? They are ruminants, right? They have four stomachs and they have to chew their cud. They have to be ruminants. And if they are ruminants, they are the furthest things away from predators that you can get, right? The furthest meat that you can consume that is as far away as possible from predation, right? They just eat grass and stuff. So one theory is that's why they're ruminants. That's why you eat ruminants, because they are the furthest away from what do you call it? Whatever I just said. Predators. All right. So chewing the cud and split hoof, right, is the qualifications for land animals that we can eat. And if it doesn't have that, verse 6, what happens? Tme'ah lachem. It is impure for you. So right now we see, okay, we had this whole verse about be careful about kadosh and chol and tuma and tahara. Be very careful about those things. Let us enumerate exactly what is going to make you tameh. Here's a very clear list. All right, so tamehu lachem on 7. It's impure for you, right? And if you touch the carcass of any of them, even the ones that are permitted to eat, if you touch their carcass, they are impure for you. Okay, here's what you can eat that lives in the water: fins and scales. Apparently, fins and scale fish have a different form of locomotion. They use their back fin for locomotion and their side fins for balance. So it is considered the more evolved fish. Say some people, like, you know, someone like Bert, who wants to figure out why are these the ones that are permitted? How does this make us better people to eat? It's because it's the more evolved fish of the fish. Okay. Also, fish that don't swim like that. This is probably not how it is done, but let's just imagine that back fit. Like, so fish that swim like this, they can swim closer to the top and they can eat stuff closer to the top, right? Because they can get up there and they can get away. Fish who don't do that are bottom feeders. They tend to stay down low and wait for things to come to them that they can eat because it comes to them, right? They can't swim up to go get stuff. So maybe another level of staying away from predators and predation. We don't know because we're not told. Torah doesn't tell us, right? It just says fins and scales.
That's why I don't like sea cucumber.
You don't like sea cucumber because?
It's terrible.
Okay. That.
What does that have to do with fins and scales?
It doesn't have any fins and scales. It's at the bottom.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
And shellfish.
Give me a shellfish.
Right. Right. So
shellfish came out.
All right. So, and some theories for the rabbis are that is that the Bible is very concerned with categories. How do we get creation? Separating. You separate out everything, staying separate, and where it belongs is how you maintain creation and stay away from chaos. Chaos is the opposite of creation. Okay. So. Things that are in the water should be in the water. Things that are on the land should be on the land. If you have something like a lobster that lives in the water but can crawl up on the land, that is getting real close to chaos. That is getting very close to the order of things getting mixed and muddied, and that's very nervous. Like, that makes us nervous. Okay. Verse 10. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Swarming things of the water. Right? They are what for you? Shekets. They are an abomination. All right. Now, we're not going to spend long here, but I just feel like it's my religious obligation always to deal with this word. Always to deal with this word. Because abomination gets thrown around out there as if it is the worst thing possible. It's abominable. It's an abomination before God. Okay. It just means taboo. Means you can't do it. Doesn't say other people don't eat it. It's just fine for other cultures if they eat lobster. That's fine. For you, it's an abomination. That means you don't do it because it is ritually forbidden. No reason. It's not about morals. It's not about ethics. It's not about because it's wrong to eat lobster. It is because you are ritually forbidden to do it, period. So people love to pull this word out and put it on the prohibition of men having sex with other men as they do with a woman. They love to pull out this word there. But those same people who just pulled out that word had bacon for breakfast, which is an abomination. They are equal. They are absolutely equal in the eyes of Torah. So people who love to pull out this word is the worst thing possible, and it's a moral, ethical judgment about the character of the person doing it because it's an abomination, right? They don't want to talk about that when they talk about eating shrimp. Okay? So just so you all know and can be armed forever. Yes, Betsy.
So we're getting to the discussion about bugs. And one thing that I don't understand, well, I don't understand a lot of things that my son rules that he follows. To me, it's a fish of gosh. But anyways, he claims that bugs are like even more, of an abomination than pork or anything else. And where would that come from?
It doesn't. There's nowhere in Torah that says that.
But they're so obsessed with bugs. That's why they have
nowhere.
I can't even serve them.
But you know what? I really don't think it's that it's more disgusting. I really don't. He may have sources that say that. I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is I think it originates with a horror of inadvertently breaking the laws of kashrut. Bugs are everywhere,
right?
And you don't always see them. I remember Eliana said the other day, Mom, remember that when we poured the honey all over the thing and it had ants in it? And like, you were like, it's okay, eat a Roundup. I'm like, did I really say that? I don't know. But it's like, you just never know. Like, you could pour syrup on your kids' pancakes and all of a sudden it's infested with ants. But what if there was only one or two in there and you didn't see them?
Yeah.
Like, so there's all these times where we eat bugs without necessarily knowing it. And I think that's the actual reaction and horror, is that I could eat one of these things and not know it.
Right.
And so then they get obsessive about washing everything. And,
right.
I think that's the reaction.
Those are prescribed period, like certain berries, because the bugs could be hiding.
So that's an obsession. This is an obsession with keeping halacha.
Yeah.
That's what I think, right? It's like, because any good rabbinic authority will tell you, if you've washed it and you eat one by accident, it doesn't count. It's not a sin. If it's bishogeg, if it's accidental, you don't get an infraction. You don't get a demerit in the big black book for it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's like to be righteously obsessed.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's a system that kind of, it lends itself to having people become so OCD halachically that it's not healthy.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember one year when I got you the crickets, and I only bought them because it said they were kosher.
Yes, that was so delightful. That was delightful.
Kosher.
Eating the crickets, yes, especially the ranch flavored ones.
It was ranch. So the barbecue was better?
All right. So you will not eat of it, and their carcass becomes an abomination. Everything in the water that is not fins and scales is an abomination. Right. These you shall abominate. I love that verb. These you shall abominate among the birds. Right. So we're going to get a list here. Right. And we're going to get a list of things that you can eat, like locusts, certain varieties of grasshopper. It depends where the thing is, the knee joint is on their legs, because it's about whether they're meant to walk or meant to fly. So where the thing is on the leg tells you whether it's supposed to be.
That what makes them kosher?
Yes. Yes. Where their knee joint is on the leg is what makes them kosher. You only know this if you know bug taxonomy, which fortunately for y'all, I clearly do. All right. All right. Now let's go to what happens if you do touch their carcass. We just got a big list of things you're not allowed to eat. And if you touch their carcass of any of them, even the ones you can eat, you are tameh, right? Anyone who carries their carcass is tameh. They have to wash those clothes, and they will remain impure until evening. Okay? Because sometimes if something drops dead, you can't leave it in the camp. It's going to cause disease. You have to carry it out. So again, this proves tumah is not bad. You have to carry it out so that people don't get sick. You have to become tameh. So if you're commanded to do it, it can't be bad. It's just not allowed in the sacred space. So if you carry the thing out, you wash those clothes because they are tameh, and you remain tameh until the evening. Okay?
Chicken carcass?
Anything. Any dead stuff. Although one commentator said the bugs, it doesn't say anything about bugs' carcasses make you unclean. Probably because we step on dead bugs all the time and are unaware of it. So the status is less. You wouldn't want that to happen to people all the time. I mean, it makes sense.
There's one group in India that brush is ahead of them so that they don't ever step on a bug.
But, right, that's about something different than Tuma and Tahara, right? That's about not taking a life. This is about what renders you
impure.
All right.
Chicken's food that you could.
As to any food that may be eaten, what happens? It becomes impure. It shall become impure if it came into contact with water. As to any liquid that may be drunk, it shall be impure if it was inside any vessel. We're talking now about the communication of tum'ah from the thing to other things. Everything on which the carcass of any of them falls. So something drops dead in the middle of the courtyard and it falls on a cup. That cup is impure. Okay. If it is earthenware, it must be destroyed because earthenware absorbs and you can't get it out. Right. So it remains impure. However, ach mayan uvor mikve mayim yiye tahor vinogea beneath latam yitame. However, a spring or a bore, a hole, in which mikveh mayim, there's a collection of mayim, that will be tahor. And it has the ability to communicate purity and to take away impurity. Yeah? What's the confusion? What's happening?
Anything to put it in the hole of the ground. Okay.
Yeah, so we're going to look for where that is. You shall not draw abomination upon yourselves, right? I, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, am your God. You shall sanctify yourselves and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not make yourselves impure through anything swarming that moves on the earth. In these systems I just talked to you about earlier, that many things are considered taboo to eat. In many of those societies, it really only mattered about the aristocracy and the priesthood. Regular people, you know, it's lowbrow, but we don't care if they eat it, right? If you take that as fact, then this verse becomes important. You shall sanctify yourselves and be holy, for I am holy. So God is saying it's not just the priests. It starts there. But where does it eventually end up, this whole idea of Tameh and Tahor? It ends up with every Israelite. I am holy, and therefore, every one of you shall guard against being impure and guarding Kedusha, because you are to be for me what? A nation of what?
Priests.
A nation of priests. You have priests, and they function in a certain way, but all y'all, to me, need to remain pure when it's important to be pure and purify when you need to and, right, follow the laws of Kedusha because I am holy and y'all need to be holy because you are an extension of me, a reflection of me, right? So in a way, although some people see this as onerous, it's actually a compliment. It's actually democratizing the people, saying the schlepper who cleans out the stables is also holy. Just because that job is filthy and nothing we would want to do, it doesn't mean anything about the inherent value of that person. And they are to be careful about the laws of Tuma and Tahara because they are an extension of God who claims, I am holy, so you shall be holy. Right? So in that sense, it's actually flattering. And it's actually a compliment and it's actually democratizing in an ancient world that was very stratified, including ancient Israel, was very stratified. You had the very, very rich and the very, very poor, and you had Israelites selling themselves into indentured servitude. I brought you from the land of Egypt to be your God, so you shall be holy, for I am. All right. So we're at 11:36, right? This whole idea about a bore, a pit, or a spring, right? Mikve Mayim, with a collection of Mayim, is tahor by definition. And what we're going to learn is anything you put in it becomes tahor, becomes pure. Okay? So, outward purity, impurity, can be removed by water. So, outward impurity can be dealt with by a source that is pure. We just learned that a mayan or a mikveh mayim is pure and communicates purity, right? So, what is so special about water, asks one of the commentaries I was studying. What is so special about water that gives it this power? I always try to name the person. Professor Menachem Dor wrote a book, Fauna in the Time of the Bible, the Mishnah, and the Talmud, really dealing with kashrut and all of these details about which animals are kosher and which are not. Why Mayim? Why water? He raises the question. Why is water exempt from getting tamei? We take it for granted. We assume it. But why? Right? Really? If you really start looking at these things, like he's looking at these things scientifically, like which shoes is good and why would that be good? And why does it mention the rabbit specifically and blah, 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 right? So, if you start going down that scientific hole, then you get to this amazing thing that I did not know. And I'm bringing it to y'all. And I started to watch a video on it and it made my head hurt so bad that I stopped watching. But you can Google it and see for yourself this Australian scientist describing the reality of this. What's so special about water that gives it this power? Water is what facilitates life on Earth. Planets that have no water cannot support life. Water is liquid because of its unusual molecular structure with a bond angle of approximately 108 degrees between the hydrogen atoms and the oxygen atoms. But I learned from the video that the hinge between the two hydrogen atoms and the oxygen atom actually shifts. It goes from 104, it can expand to 108. So it's not fixed. So when water freezes, that angle of each molecule changes, right? Which is what enables it to be liquid, solid, or gas. Right. All right. So 108 degrees between the hydrogen atoms and the oxygen atom. In his youth, the great German mathematician Carl Friedrich Gauss wrote that the world exists, quote, thanks to a 108 degree angle. Death is impurity. We know that, right? Death communicates the highest level of impurity. And you've heard me give the argument before that every law about what makes us tamei is really about death in life, right? If you have a baby, you're impure for a bunch of time, right? Because women and infants came very close to death every time there was a birth, right? So all moments of tuma, all things that communicate impurity are by definition death in life. Death is impurity. Water, which supports and facilitates life, represents purity. Okay. I kind of buy it, right? I kind of buy that. If water is what makes life possible, then it kind of makes sense that water and blood, which is the life force, that both of those are agents that can take out the deathness of something that renders it impure. Let's go to some sources. So here's the article. If you want to look at it, it's this wonderful article. Bert will post it for you. The link is on your screen for this article on Kashrut, if you really want to go more deeply into this business. But we're going to go to this wonderful set of sources brought by David Kasher in his piece, Waters of Hope, from Hadar. So you can find it on Hadar's website. And he brings us this business from Leviticus about, however, a spring or cistern in which water is collected shall be pure. Whoever touches such a carcass, right, blah, blah, blah. Let's look at the root of this business of mikveh mayim. Mikveh mayim, a collection of water. So if you go to Brown, Driver, and Briggs, if you go to the Biblical Hebrew Dictionary, kavah, the verb to collect, So this is, there's many different iterations of kava. One of them being this idea of to collect. Put a mem in front of that and you have a noun. Mikveh mayim. If kava is collect as a verb, that which is collected is mikveh, is a collection, right? So a collection of water, the word mikveh is first used here in Torah.
Is that the same as
it? Yes, of course. Yeah. Of course. That's why we're going there. Of course. So this is the beginning of the Israelite concept, which later becomes a Jewish concept. There's no Judaism yet. There's only Israelite cult practice. When there's Judaism, one thing that remains is an understanding of tuma and tahara, purity and impurity, vis-a-vis family purity, meaning the laws of menstruation, and some around pregnancy and some around stuff for men as well. So that remains part of the system. Why? Don't get me started, but it is what it is. It remains. So that we need an agent of purification is for human beings in certain instances, but also in what we saw about vessels that get contaminated with impurity. They have to be made tahor. We would use the word kasher, right? They have to be koshered in purifying water, right? So if you stick your fork into a piece of shrimp by accident, what your fork is doing around shrimp, I'm not going to ask about. That is private for y'all. But somehow it gets into shrimp. Now your fork is not kosher anymore. It has to be toibled, right? It has to be put in a mikveh to be. So some of this system actually carries forward and remains a big part of some Jewish life for a lot of people, right? Kashrut takes up a huge amount of time and energy and resources. If you have to build a house that has two dishwashers, I'm sorry, and two sinks with two separate drains that never cross, that's hugely expensive. Have you priced kosher chicken or kosher meat recently? Right? It's an incredible investment into a system. Four sets of dishes, too casual, too dressy, right? Silverware, then Pesach. Forget about Pesach. Now you need milchik and fleishig for Pesach on top of milchik and fleishig daily dishes and milch and fleishig china. Right. Now you need pesedik, china, milchik, and dairy. I mean, milchik and fleishig. Okay, right. So it's very complicated and eats up a huge amount of particularly women's time and energy and focus. All right. So where's the first place we see this idea of a gathering of water? The first place we see it actually is in Genesis 1, 9 through 10. God said, Yikavu hamayim mitachat hashamayim. Gather. We say in English, let the waters be gathered. Yikavu, it's a command. Gather, y'all. What's the y'all? Waters, plural in Hebrew. So gather, y'all, waters under the heavens into one place so that we now have dry land. Okay? So this is the first place we see this idea of waters gathering is actually in creation. Waters gathering together is at God's command so that there can be something other than water. Okay. And then we see in Exodus, God says to Moshe, verse 19 of chapter 7, take your rod and hold your arm over the waters of Egypt, its rivers, its canals, its ponds, all its bodies of water, that they may turn to blood. Right? So these things are called mikveh mei mehem, and all the gatherings of their waters, like all places that their waters gather, lakes, stream, you know, wherever Egypt's waters gather, mikveh mei mehem, that's going to be turned to blood. Okay, so it's present there in Exodus as well. Now, kaveh takes on another meaning, and this is like a beautiful part of our literary tradition. Kava comes from the verb, another sense of the verb of kava is to wait for. And how do we get to wait for from kavak? Kav is a line, a string, right? In the ancient world, lines, you know, would have often been string, right? They did a lot of weaving. You look at a, this thing says you look at a spider web. Those strands is a kav. If you pull on a string, what happens?
Stretches or breaks.
It stretches or breaks.
Elongates.
Yes. But if, but what, what happens is tension. So if you pull on a line, you get tension. So from this understanding of what happens in the world comes this idea of the tension of waiting. Waiting implies anticipation, right? It doesn't say you're just sitting around doing nothing. Waiting means you might be doing nothing, but it means you're anticipating something that's coming. You're waiting for it. There's a tension in that as you're waiting for it. So, which I never knew this, that this is how we got the word kava, as tikva, as it comes from tension. It comes from waiting. So mikveh, the noun mikveh here is hope. So now let's look at Jeremiah, who is aware of this double use of the verb, of the root kava. One is lekavot, one is a different form of that three-letter root, but he knows it's the same three-letter root. So he beautifully plays on it in chapter 17, Jeremiah, or the school of Jeremiah does. What does Jeremiah call God in chapter 17, verse 13? Mikveh Yisrael, hope of Israel, right? All for who forsake you shall be put to shame. Those in the land who turn from you shall be doomed, for they have forsaken God, Mikor Mayim Chaim, the source of living water. So Jeremiah is aware that he is playing on mikveh as hope and mikveh as a gathering of waters that purify, right? You are for mikveh Yisrael, hope of Israel. All y'all who forsake the font of living water, blah, blah. He is very aware of this wordplay, which I think is beautiful. So Kasher in his article says, here once again, God is the mikveh, the hope of Israel. But centuries later, Rabbi Akiva finds a more optimistic reading of this verse, and in doing so also suggests a connection between the uses, two uses of the word mikveh. Amar Rabbi Akiva, this is in the Mishnah. Rabbi Akiva says, and he's going to go on and quote our verse that we just looked at, right? At Jeremiah 17:13. Ve'omer, and it says, mikveh Yisrael Adonai, right? God is the hope of Israel. Ma mikveh, what is a mikveh? Mitaher et ha-tameim. What is a mikveh? A mikveh is that which purifies those who are impure. Af, and so, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the KBH, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, the Holy Blessed One, mitaher et Yisrael, purifies Israel. So Rabbi Akiva is now making this beautiful move from the implicit hint of Jeremiah, God is the hope of Israel, the font of living waters, the connection between those, and Akiva makes it explicit. Why does Jeremiah call God Mikveh Yisrael? Don't think it's because God is the hope of Israel. Of course, God's the hope of Israel. We know that, but it's because what does the mikveh do? A mikveh purifies that which is impure. Just so does God purify that which is impure. What purifies Israel? What a beautiful image. Why am I so excited about this image? Because I think it's an incredibly beautiful thing to say God is, don't read mikveh Yisrael, the hope of Israel. Read instead, God is Israel's mikveh. When we immerse in, the, when we bathe, beautiful Sarah, when we bathe in the divine, we are made pure. We are returned to a state of purity. Rabbi Akiva's borrowing from the imagery we found in Leviticus, blah, 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 right? Immersion in God is cleansing, like dipping into water from a spring. we purge ritual impurity by immersing in a designated measure of water, but God is the true mikveh of Israel, who can purge us of all our impurities and bring us back into a state of ritual purity. But of course, Jeremiah, also intends the contextual meaning of the word. God is the hope of Israel. Wait for it. You ready? A message for our time, people. To immerse in God, then, if we read take Jeremiah seriously, means to plunge ourselves into hopefulness, to sink into our faith and believe that we will be changed when we emerge from the source of living waters. Boom!
And here we are.
And here we are, Sarah Moskowitz. Here we are. We are sitting around this table because we choose to descend into the mikveh of Yisrael, which Jeremiah knows is the hope of Israel, but knows it's playing on the idea of God as mikveh that Akiva makes clear. But now, full circle, go back from Akiva, who says, because God is the purifier, the mikveh of Israel, go back to Jeremiah. What purifies Israel? What brings us back to our best, most wonderful state? Immersion in hope. Hope is what we must immerse in if we are to come back to a place of purity, so that we can act in all kinds of ways in the world that won't happen when we're made tameh by our cynicism, our fear controlling everything, our reactivity, our habits, Egyptomania, right?
It's very challenging.
But my knowledge, we in Judaism, and maybe I'm wrong, we don't, as versus in baptism, where they, to be cut, people immerse themselves in order to be baptized. Judaism, to my knowledge, we don't have that kind of ritual where we immerse ourselves in a body of water.
Still, we do. We have mikvah, but it is not to cleanse us of sin. Mm-hmm. And it is not to be born in Christ Jesus, obviously. We do immerse to change our state from impure to pure and to make a transition where baptism got it from. Is mikveh, yeah. And got it from the transition that is made possible by a mikveh of being non-Jewish to Jewish. So when you go into the waters of the mikveh as a non-Jew for the intentions, with the intent to convert and join the people Israel, those waters are understood to be birthing waters. You are born again into the Jewish people. You are born to Abraham and Sarah through these waters. That is where the idea of being born again into Jesus and into the body of the church, right?
Right.
That's where it comes from. It comes from us having that understanding of changing status. And, David, through mikveh.
And then go to the mikveh too.
Yes, go, David.
No, if you know, taking everything that you just said, what's interesting about what I noticed for the first time is that the thing that makes it purifying is the fact that it's renewing itself, that it's not stagnant. I mean, it's almost, you could almost think that as a metaphor for evolving or growing, you know, like the body of order that's, it needs water coming in and water going out, which wants a certain turnover. And that's what makes it purifying. It's the dynamicism, is that a word?
Oh, dynamism.
Sorry, of the water that is sort of secret rather, you know, at least in the way that.
So I love the metaphor. I just don't want us to get too halachically oriented. That's halacha. The Torah doesn't say that. The Torah doesn't say has to have water coming in and water going out. By definition, anything that collects rainwater is by definition pure and communicates purity. So, but to your point, maybe part of that is because always a cistern that collects rainwater, whenever it rains, is going to have more rain added to it. Like there, it is always going to have, if it's a lake, it's always going to have water coming in and by definition, water going out. So we could assume that about it, but it's not made explicit until halacha, right? The rabbis go there. Harvey?
Interesting about water on earth is that water really is eternal. The amount of water on earth now, 3 billion years ago, it's the same amount of water now. It just moves around and around through the dinosaurs. It's the same amount of water. It's always been here. Same amount.
Okay, that's freaky.
There's no water getting formed. It changes to ice, or if you guess, but it's always water. Same amount. It's eternal. Freaky.
That is very freaky. Because you think about water evaporating, but what you're saying is, yeah, so it condenses in clouds and then comes down as rain.
Yeah, in space anywhere.
And we're positive it's the same amount of water?
And how do we ever drown?
Well, because it's not here. The water's not here. It's raining somewhere else, or the water's doing, because it hasn't risen and become clouds and come down. Okay, that's going to freak me out for a while. Go ahead, Lisa.
Revolutionary stuff in the sense that it's like what you say about the food, that this is not just for the priests. The special food, the special water, but everybody is involved in the mixture and that whole fullness, and everybody's involved with being kosher. Now it's really kosher. But I mean, that this is not just something, this is something we're all responsible for ourselves, be part of this system and this community. And it's not just something to push off on a priest.
Right. The everyday life, it has a concern that our tradition is concerned for everybody to have a life that is reflective of holiness in all kinds of ways. This is about the everyday, because every day people have to eat. So if you have to tend to holiness several times a day, then attach it to food, right? Because you become thoughtful about it, right? And so every Israelite, no matter how poor what's on their table is, right, is commanded to understand that they too participate, right, in this idea of it's really beautiful. It's a really beautiful democratizing, which, to Betsy, your point, my grandmother, who married my Orthodox grandfather at the age of 18, and he was way older than her. He was her boss. Don't tell anybody. And so she had to learn what it meant to keep kosher to the level she was given on her wedding day, the gift of a book, The Duties of the Daughters of Israel, which I keep in my study so that whenever I get upset about the state of things in the world, it's like, okay, you could have been given this. And another book that was all about the halacha around keeping kosher. And only at the end of her life did she talk to me about how much she hated doing it. That it was so time consuming and so ridiculously detailed. And he would come check labels, and he would come, my grandfather would come check this. And didn't I see that spoon outside? How do we know it didn't come into, like, and you know, so what can be so beautiful can, the flip side is that when we get so crazy, right. And, but so I guess what I'm saying is, for me, it's always helpful to come back to the beauty of something that can be so onerous. And to come back to this beautiful idea of that it's a democratizing of the idea of holiness, and our eating every day being one opportunity to make those decisions. And it doesn't have to just be about kasher and not kasher now, obviously. A lot of us have decisions that we make about eating that are about our morals and our values and about holiness around, there are things we don't eat because it's cruel. Like, I stopped eating foie gras, not that I ate it so frequently, but I love foie gras. I love veal, like, but I won't eat it. And I'm not saying I'm so righteous. I eat meat. I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying there are some things that now we decide are part of our expression of our values by not eating them or eating them, like free range or whatever, because we understand from a very long time ago that every time we sit down to eat, which we do every day, several times a day, we have an opportunity to be invited into thoughtfulness about living lives of holiness.
About mikveh too, it's more than just for a conversion process. Men can go into the mikveh. Dishes can go into the mikveh.
We said that. Like, right. That
it has all
there are things, right, that have to be toiveled. Like, things that get trafed have to be toiveled, have to go into the mikveh.
One of the things I had a discussion with my son about was just how there's so many different levels of kashrut, and so, you know, one person's kashrut, somebody's shomer kashrut, but to somebody else, that's not enough. You know, and they abide by different hectares on the products.
Sure.
So I was saying to him, well, you know, if we're all Jews, then why is this okay for some and it's not for others? I mean, I don't understand.
Because you're not putting yourself in the halachic mindset.
But why are all these, there's so much differentiation, like between, I'm talking about like between
yes, the no, but, Orthodox. But you have to remember, who makes the ultimate decision about whether or not you can eat it, Betsy, in your son's world? Right. Who makes the decision?
Whatever's written in the books.
No. If there's a question,
he did,
right? No. Who makes the decision? The Rebbe. His Rebbe is his authority.
Yeah.
His Rebbe takes the sin off of your son. The sin's on the Rebbe if the Rebbe's wrong. Your son is completely absolved if his Rebbe says he can eat it. So if this Rebbe says yes and that Rebbe says no, that's how it happens, that you have a legal authority. This, why do we have an appellate court? If we all follow the same laws, why do we have an appellate court system? Because this judge disagrees with that judge, and now you're going to go to the big judge, right? So that's how it happens. Yes, we're all under one framework, but if you have different authorities, authorities are going to disagree on what the standard is. So then you're living in a world where authorities are pitted against authorities, and it's crazy to us.
Yeah.
But look at the legal system. How can we have the same set of laws and have as many things as I'm hearing on, you know, MSNBC right now about filing this and filing that and filing this and appellate court this and appellate? Because yes, we live under one law, and there's all kinds of opinions about that law. And that's what happens in that system, right? So I wanna go to our final source. This is Virginia Spatz. If mikvah can mean both a pool of water and hope, what is the connection between the two? In Israel, having a storehouse of collected rainwater would certainly mean one has hope. All through Israel, one can find ancient cisterns that the Israelites carved out of rock. A pit without water would be a symbol of hopelessness. And Jeremiah would know, like Joseph, since he was thrown into a muddy pit. So I love this idea that the collection of water goes back to the idea of living in a place where you depended on rain to survive. So any place you had a collection of water, it was by definition hopeful, right? You could water your animals. You could water your crops, right? Along this path of transformation, we know the pain of loss and conflict can be our teacher to see clearly and feel clearly where change is underway. As we honor the complexity of life and the new forms emerging from the brine of fermentation, from our bodies, from the mikveh, we honor the pain that has been our teacher in seeing and knowing sites of transformation, to draw our attention to them and not just turn away from the pain. We honor our own fierce bravery in not turning away from pain, but moving into and through the liminal places. And we honor need for rest and care in holding the beautiful divinity of our queer bodies, our crocs, our mikvaot, our vessels of transformation. This is a queer sculptor, Nikki Green, talking about like the well of life, life-giving waters are all about transforming us in liminal spaces. And that part of the beauty of this mikvah, every time we go to mikvah, is to say, I honor the places that I need transformation, right? And I honor that rather than just turn away from it and ignore it. And we enter the water and brings this beautiful bracha. Nivarech et ha-ma'ayan. Let us bless the wellspring. Eloheinu ruach ha'olam. Our God, spirit of the universe. Shinotenet in the feminine. Shinotenet chayim, who gives life. Shemei vimavet, and brings death. Vitoseset shinui, and ferment change. Hmm. And we will close our time together. Bert's going to have to cut out a bunch of stuff to keep us honest. And here we go. I just love this. And so this is my final offering to you. Naked. Let's all go downstairs all together to a hole. I'm going to make this bigger so y'all can see it on the screen. Let's all go downstairs all together to a hole in the basement. And while we're there, we'll take our clothes off, slip off our shoes, let down our hair. Some folks unpeel just like an onion, and in some ways, they're just as smelly. And some guys shed the way a viper does its skin. And you know why? Because they've been poisoned. And other fellows let it all drop like an oak tree in the autumn, and they are just as straight and grand. There go our neckties, our silver watches, our gold-toe socks, our high-top Nikes, off with those thick and woolen tzitzis, the undershirts, the underwear. Let's all get naked. This is my body that I've had my whole life long. It's got its scars, discolorations, some sagging parts, unimpressive features. And that's your body. It's not so different. We both got legs and hair and noses. It's all just skin and nails and flesh that's full of life and hope and longing. So let's get wet. Dive in the mikveh. Let's all be clean. Let's all be pure. Let's all be righteous. Let's all be holy. Let's all show goodwill yes. to one another and be adored by God in heaven and God on earth, because he's the same God. God of our bodies and of his soul and of her spirit and of my testicles. So let's be naked like little babies who have no words, who don't know labels, who aren't blinded by ideologies or by hatred or by propaganda. I want to be naked in the mikveh with the Lubavitcher Rebbe and Walt Whitman. The Rebbe's doing backflips. He's doing cannonballs. And both their beards are so impressive, the Rebbe says, I'm not the Mashiach. And then Walt laughs, says, sure you are. Mashiach's coming, naked and happy. He's just like us. We're just like him. So you're Mashiach. But so am I. And so is Aaron. And so is Jake. And so is Dina. The Rebbe nods and blows some bubbles. And then he smiles. And then he laughs. He says, that's what I was trying to tell them. Maybe they'll get it right this year.
You've been listening to Rabbi Amy Bernstein's Friday Morning Torah Study from Kehillat Israel in Pacific Palisades, California. For more information, go to our website, www.ourki.org.